Well, welcome. How are you? You all are just too quiet and too polite, and we're going to hopefully change that in the next few minutes, okay? So, hey, as we get going, I do want to throw up a picture up on the screen of just our family. We know several of you well. You're very close friends of ours. We love you. There's so many that we don't know at all, and you will see my wife Lisa floating around here through the weekend. There's a picture of Lisa and me on our 25th anniversary a handful of years ago. We have five children, four are adult kids, and one is a fourth grader, and then we have four grandchildren. You know, I did look up there, Lisa, the pictures you emailed in, honey. I don't know what's going on, but our son-in-law Daniel is not in them. And so I think there are issues going on between Daniel and Lisa. But Daniel is usually behind the camera, and so we don't have a picture of him. But trust me, he's a good man, and he's in the picture as well. We will look forward to getting to know you. And I want to say on the front end, thank you to Erin, but to Terry Tomlinson, to the group of volunteers she's put together. Unbelievable job in planning and prepping this. And I tell you, we will be well led through this weekend. I'm being led by her as well. Erin and I would both say we work for Terry, and we're glad to work for Terry because she's leading this well, and I think we're going to have a good weekend in front of us. We're looking forward to this weekend with you. We really are. Hopefully, we'll have a chance to talk about some things that are most meaningful to marriage, but the same kinds of things that unfortunately we don't often talk about enough. Or when we do talk about them, they come out only in the heat of conflict. And that's usually not our best prime time for really addressing the hardest issues of marriage, is it? I had the privilege, and I use the word in air quotes if that's okay, privilege of being four of my kids' driver's ed instructor. I did it because I found out how much it costs to actually pay someone else to teach your kids how to drive. You know why it costs that much, right? Because it's hard. And it's unpleasant, and they don't like it, and you don't like it either. But as my friends and my wife will tell you, the word discount or cheap, those are love language words for me. And so I'm always looking for a way to get something done a little cheaper than we could have done it. And so I thought, if they can teach them, I can teach them. And what we found out for all four of the kids, but particularly two of our kids, it just happened to be our two daughters. It's no gender role stereotyping there. It just happened to be that our two girls struggled with the exact same thing. And that was how to keep the car in the middle of the lane. We live in East Rogers. The roads are kind of country roads out there. The roads are narrow. There are drainage ditches to the right and little double yellow lines to the left. And every one of the kids would start to take and just accidentally start to drift over the center line. And as soon as they did that, I would be kind of pushing for the brake that I didn't have on my side of the car. And I would be kind of hands on the dashboard. And I would say, center line! And they'd overcorrect real quickly, and they'd start to head towards the drainage ditch. That's way scarier than a center line. And I would go, center line, center line. And we would look like a 15-year-old was DUI all the way home with her daddy riding shotgun with her. And for every one of the kids, it was that way. And until the oldest, I stumbled across a little driver's ed tip. They call it high-aim driving. Next time we got in the car, I said, sweetheart, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to take your vision, and I don't want you to put it on where we are right now, where the car is right now. I want you to set your vision kind of higher up on where we're going to be, maybe a tenth of a mile, two-tenths of a mile down the road. Just see what happens to the car. Drive the same way you were, but just raise your vision. And almost magically, the car just kind of straightened out in the lanes. They call it high-aim driving for drivers, but in life, you know, we call it high-aim living. Listen, my kids weren't weaving and overcorrecting because they weren't trying. I mean, all you had to do was look at their furrowed brows. All you had to do was watch the white knuckles on the steering wheel, and you knew they were trying. But they were constantly overcorrecting with more effort. And I got a hunch there are many who've white-knuckled and furrow-browed their way into here tonight. You have been overcorrecting and overcorrecting from one extreme to the other in your marriage, from hyper-aggressive, we're going to solve this issue, to let's just deny that it ever came up. And it's not working very well. And you've told yourself, if I can just try harder, we're going to make this thing a happy journey. And yet the white knuckles and the furrowed brows, they just get deeper. Well, what if the issue wasn't just so much how hard you tried? But what if it was how high your vision was? And that's what we want to do tonight. on the very outset, we want to try to raise our vision on marriage. I want to give you a few tips on the front end of this whole series. A few things as we start out. First, this is really more of a series about biblical manhood and womanhood than it is about marriage. Now, it wasn't a bait and switch. I promise you, we're going to apply it to marriage. But have you not noticed that marriage is made up of a man and a woman coming together? And if they can learn to right themselves, they might learn to live rightly with one another. I know that we think we have marriage issues. I usually have Mark issues, and Lisa has Lisa issues, and it just shows up in their marriage. How about you? So we're going to talk about biblical manhood and womanhood and how the two come together in teamwork and marriage. Second thing I want to promise you right up front is this will not be four steps to a better marriage. Three easy habits to a great relationship. It's going to be really more of a weekend focused on the how comes of marriage more than the how to's. Now, it will be practical. Trust me, even tonight as we get into the session on resolving conflict, it will be practical. But what we're going to try to do is get a passion for why we're a couple in the first place before we figure out how to do marriage well. The most practical thing we need is clearer and bigger vision. The other third thing I want to say on the front end is that we are not experts. In fact, Lisa and I have a deep conviction, and it's that we are always rookies all the time. So about 30 years ago this month, we were truly rookies. We'd been married 6, 7, 8 weeks. But you know what? Right now, 30 years later, we're still rookies. This is the first time that we have had four adult children and an elementary school child at the same time, okay? This is the first time we've been grandparents. It's the first time we're providing care for aging parents. It's the first time we're the guardians of a disabled brother-in-law. This is all new terrain for us. How about you and your marriage? My hunch is you're a rookie in the season you're entering as well. So guess what? We now keep our rookie hat on, and we keep humble, and we keep learning and choosing to grow. And so that's where we'll go this weekend. And to start us off, we've got to ask a question you probably have not asked for a long time. Why? Why are you married in the first place? No, really. I've worked as a pastor for at least a few decades now that I know that the only people who ever ask that question are our singles, and they ask it like this, you know, why should we get married anyway? Well, the other couples that ask it are our couples that are in deep crisis, but they ask it like this. I mean, why marriage anyway? And it's frustration. Everybody else between the time they're, before they get hitched, to the time that they're already in a ditch, all they're doing is asking how marriage. And how marriage is an okay question. It's just not a great question. And it's certainly not the best question. If we could drop back and really answer the question, why marriage, you would find something magical happening. You would find that the answer that you come up with reveals the vision that you have for your relationship as a couple. I mean, why marriage? Once we get that fixed in our minds, we have now revealed the purpose for our marriage. And purpose is absolutely huge. I've got a core conviction in all of life. It certainly applies to marriage. But the conviction is simply this. Passion follows purpose. Your passion in life always follows your purpose for life. That was true of your job today. Let's say both you and your spouse went to work today. Let's say he came home and his real purpose for being at that job today was that he needed a paycheck because he has creditors who want his money. But at the same token, she went to her job. She's grateful for the paycheck because she's glad to provide for her family and to share with others in need. But she also thinks that that job exists because she's supposed to showcase a little bit more of who God is on the job. So like, if Jesus had her job, this is how he would do it with excellence. This is the way he would serve people. This is just the way he would solve problems and relate at the same time. Both of them came home today at the end of the day. Both of them quickly scrambled, argued about what time this thing started, quickly got kids where they needed to be, jumped in the car, and while they were driving down I-49, turned to each other and said, oh yeah, how was your day at work? My hunch is you've got two different answers. Her passion for her job is higher than his. Why? Because her purpose was higher. Passion follows purpose. And nowhere is that more true than in marriage itself. And so what we need most is renewed vision that's locked in on the highest purposes for marriage. And when we talk about high purposes for marriage, you're talking about God's purposes for marriage. And so we drop back to the original picture, the original art, the original vision for marriage. And if you had a Bible, you'd actually turn to page 1 to find it. And you drop into Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea, birds of the sky, over the livestock, over all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground." So, punchline, God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Did you catch it? Is it so commonplace that you went by it too quick? Anybody feel goosebumps? The hair on anybody's neck stand up? Look at it again, verse 27. God created mankind in his image. In his image. Male and female, he created them. And that means that our marriage exists to be a picture of the living God. Can you get a purpose higher than that? Just try. Try to one-up God himself. Not happiness, not companionship, not children, not sex. Marriage may meet all those other needs, and I'm glad it does. But the reason that we are together is to be a picture of God himself on planet Earth. And if passion follows purpose, well, then a couple who actually sees that as their vision, but then actually gets up every day and just chases it a little bit. You show me that couple, and I'll show you a couple that soars with passion through the decades. And when you ask them, how do you make a long-term marriage so vibrant? They'll tell you, we're chasing something bigger than ourselves. Every wedding I perform, I say the same thing to a bride and groom that was said to Lisa and I when we were married 30 years ago. The pastor who married us looked like he was right about to go into that great part, "And now I pronounce you husband and wife, you may kiss the bride." And he went like this, "And now," and he paused. And he said, "Mark, Lisa, from this day forward, go make your marriage a great picture of Jesus. Now you may kiss the bride." And it was though I went, "Oh, that's why we're married?" See, we hadn't had any premarital counseling up to that point. But in the 1.5 seconds before he pronounced us husband and wife, we got the best premarital counseling I ever heard. Because that one truth has empowered everything about our marriage. You mean that's why we're together? That's why we do breakfast? Oh, that gives meaning to our most exciting experience as a couple. Oh, that gives dignity to the most daily mundane rhythms as a couple. That we could actually showcase off a little bit of who Jesus is through the ordinary and the extraordinary of this relationship. Couples who live without that vision, they dry up. You show me a couple who's relatively emotionally healthy, where she thinks that the reason they're married is that that marriage and that man are going to make her happy, and he thinks the same thing when he looks at her, and I'll show you a couple that within 5 years, this is what you hear in their relationship. And they have drunk each other dry. And they're screaming for passion because we're all hungry for it. And so they say, "We need a passion hit. You know what we need to do? We need to travel more. We need better date nights. And we need to purchase a new house. We need to do something, almost like a little adrenaline shot of passion that will do something to infuse the relationship." And yet what they need is a better vision of why they're a couple in the first place. That God desires to paint his very nature, meaning who he is, on the ordinary canvas of their lives. Just think about who God is. Just think about your favorite attributes of God that just never cause you to cease from worship and amazement. You know you're thinking about his unconditional love, aren't you? His tender mercy, his strong faithfulness. You know you're thinking about the gentle patience. You're thinking about the beauty of his holiness. Now listen, if God just spilled a little bit of that onto your lives and your relationship, your neighbors would look at you and say, what is up with them? They're living a fairy tale. But they'd be wrong. You're not living a fairy tale at all. You're starting to paint a divine portrait on the canvas of your ordinary relationship. God gets a lot of glory for that, and you get a ton of joy all at the same time. So how does God paint that kind of divine portrait through an ordinary man and woman? The answer, he uses ordinary men and women. And that's what he said he was going to do from page one of the Bible. He said, in the image of God, he created them. No period there. Semicolon. Male and female, he created them. That means that we are not just two people in a relationship. I have relationships with lots of people. But when it comes to marriage, we're not just two people in a relationship. We're a man and a woman in a marriage. And that makes all the difference in the world. That tells us something. Genesis 1:27 tells us something huge, especially in a time like ours and in our culture. Gender matters. Gender matters far more than we know, because gender is how God chooses to reflect himself on planet Earth, which is really quite amazing when you think of God himself. He has no gender. God is not male nor female, right? He is spirit. But when he said, I wanted to showcase myself off on planet Earth, what I want to do is I want to make a masculine image of myself and a feminine image of myself, and I want to bring them together so that they'll have a more complete image of me. Gender matters. That means a one-sexed creation cannot reflect the glory of God to the fullest. My wife Lisa was an early childhood development major at the University of New Mexico. It's an institution that prided itself on liberal thought. It would have turned the U of A into a kind of a John Brown university by comparison. And in the early childhood department, there was one class, not a class that she had, but they took a doll that they named Gobi, G-O-B-E. And Gobi was neither male nor female. You could not tell what Gobi was. And the point was that they were supposed to go into all of the pre-Ks in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and to all the four-year-old children there, they were supposed to do a presentation that told children, go be what you want to be, i.e., don't let gender stereotypes slow you down on anything. Now, let's applaud the motive, because I'm high on the motive, and I hope you are too. And that is, they wanted people to see that if both little boys and little girls could see that they were completely equal, then they would treat each other more valuably. But the problem was their definition of how equality happened. They believed equality only came from sameness. If little boys and little girls were identically the same, then there would be no treating one another with any kind of less value. But equality doesn't come from sameness. Equality comes from source, right? Lisa is made in the image of God. Mark is made in the image of God. When that man or woman get that firmly set in their mind, will you start to treat one another as though it were true? So how would it change? I mean, if you really believed your spouse was made in the image of God and showcasing who God was in their masculinity and their femininity, how would that change the way you relate to them? Well, let me ask you this. What was the last way you related to something that looked like the image of God on planet Earth? So the last time you drove on a late October day and you saw amazing colors all over the Boston Mountains, what did you do? Did you just drive by and say, happens every year? Or did you pull over and take a picture of it? Put it on your Facebook, just in case your friends forgot it was autumn. Just to remind them that Christmas is around the corner. That's why you put it on Facebook, right? No, you were in awe. There was gratitude. I'm seeing something that I didn't make that I'm appreciating. How about the last time you saw a sunset? You got home from work, you started getting out of the driveway, and it caught you on the western sky, and you just went, oh my. And you paused and you looked at it. Why did you pause and look at it? Because you've never seen a sunset before? No, because you'd never seen that sunset before. And there was awe and there was gratitude. You didn't look for one moment and say, really, God, again? I mean, every 24 hours you do this, it feels like it's just getting old. No, there was something in there that caught you to awe and to gratitude. Your last trip through the Rocky Mountains. Why did you go to the Rockies? Because you wanted to be caught up in awe and gratitude over something bigger and better than yourself. Well, listen. Fall colors, sunsets, Rocky Mountains, they've got nothing compared to the woman that I married. Nothing. And that's not just because I think Lisa's beautiful. She is, but that's not why. It's because when God made the grandeurs of this earth, the psalmist says that he made creation like a work of his fingertips. A little craft project in the back room, poof, Milky Way galaxy. As though he made a little painting in his craft room and signed it, Yahweh, in the corner. That was this world. But when he made man and woman, he did not put his signature on us. He blew his spirit into us. We became a spark of the divine, a reflection of his image, whether through masculinity or through femininity. And when I get that, when Lisa and I look at each other with those kinds of eyes, we stop and say, there's something bigger going on in my marriage than just me. And I am being invited into it. Genesis 1 gives us a vision of why marriage. You are made to come together. If you press the metaphor a little more, you take a canvas called marriage, and you take a man who's like a brush and a woman who's like a palette, and they come together and they paint. Now, Christian marriage is not a paint-by-number project. You're going to have a ton of freedom. You're going to be different as a couple. You'll have different backgrounds, passions, interests, seasons of life. But God will say, I'm going to give you a frame of masculinity and femininity coming together in oneness. And if you'll take that framework seriously, I'll put my spirit in you and I'll empower you to paint something that looks a lot like me and you'll never regret it. So how does he do it? Genesis chapter 2.